Hello there, this is the On Science podcast from NPR. I'm Andrew Prince. Japan was rocked by a massive 8.9 magnitude earthquake on March 11th. The shaking was violent, and the lion's share of the damage came from the tsunami that followed shortly thereafter. So we'll lead off the podcast this week with coverage of the quake. NPR's Christopher Joyce brings us the story of the anatomy of a tsunami, and following that, we'll hear how a nuclear reactor in the area is faring.
The tsunami rolled past Hawaii this morning, with some places reporting surges of 6 or 7 feet, according to experts at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Hours later, Crescent City, California, at the northern end of the state, got hit harder. Rich Young is harbor master at the fishing town. He and everyone else there had been evacuated early this morning, as have residents of many western seaside communities. Young says the harbor took a beating.
The entire inner boat basin here is destroyed. There are approximately 35 boats that are sunk. Boats are jumbled on top of each other, and it's just it's a hell of a mess.
Young, reporting from an emergency center near the town, says no injuries had been reported. Young says the first wave measured at about 6 feet. It didn't push water up onto land, but the huge surge of water did destroy docks and boats. It was like a 6-foot tide that normally would rise slowly over 8 hours.
In a tsunami, it happens in 15 or 20 minutes. You just get this enormously strong current. It's like Niagara Falls in a harbor.
As Young was describing the damage, he got word of yet another wave.
Cindy Henderson, the director of the Emergency Operations Center, just said that we just had an 8.1-foot wave.
Those waves started on the other side of the Pacific and took about 12 hours to cross the ocean. The amount of energy the quake released was about 30 times the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. It was a subduction zone quake where a section of the sea floor suddenly thrusts up and down. That, explains geophysicist Eric Geist of the U.S. Geological Survey, lifts the water above the seabed all the way up to the surface.
It's lifting the whole water column up above where it's not supposed to be, and then the tsunami waves spread out from there.
Japan has what scientists say is the most comprehensive tsunami warning system in the world. Engineers have stretched cables out from the land and attached instruments that measure water pressure and tides. NOAA's Pacific Tsunami Warning Center also operates its own set of warning sensors, 32 of them in the Pacific alone. Laura Fergioni is a NOAA scientist.
Within 9 minutes, our Pacific Tsunami Warning Center had a warning out for Japan, Russia, Marcus Island, and the Northern Marianas Islands. And 12 minutes later, our West Coast and Alaska Tsunami Warning Center had a message out.
But geophysicist Eric Geist says that's not a lot of time for Japanese coastal communities. The nearest city to the quake's epicenter was just about 80 miles away. Geist says there may have only been about 15 minutes of warning.
Even with a good system like that, there's just a limited amount of time you can get out of harm's way in terms of a tsunami. Some people will always be caught up in that kind of a short time frame.
As the waves traveled east toward Hawaii and North America, the warning system's pressure sensors on the seafloor monitored the tsunami's speed and predicted when the wave might hit. Once a tsunami reaches the shallows, the mass of water bunches up. There's nowhere for it to go but up. And the wave bounces off land masses, which creates a chaotic pattern of new waves.
It's very difficult to predict exactly how high the tsunami is going to be, so that uncertainty is something we're still having to live with, I think.
Another uncertainty, how many more waves are still to come? Scientists are warning coastal residents that waves could continue to arrive for hours after the first one. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Here's another problem created by the earthquake off Japan. A nuclear power plant is in trouble. Thousands of people have been evacuated from the area near a nuclear reactor on the coast in Fukushima Prefecture. Its cooling system has been running on batteries. And if the system fails, the plant's radioactive core could melt down. NPR's John Hamilton joins me now to talk about what Japan is facing. And John, Japan is calling this an atomic power emergency.
Right. Well, that's what they do when there's the potential for a release of radioactive material from a power plant. So far, it appears that there hasn't been any actual release. And it's worth noting that the nuclear power plants in Japan include a lot of safeguards. In this case, for instance, when the earthquake hit, the plant automatically shut down the nuclear reaction. The thing is that you can't just switch off radioactivity. The reaction stops, but there's a lot of radioactive stuff that's left, and it's still producing heat. So this plant, which is a couple hundred miles north of Tokyo, this plant needs to keep its cooling system going for a couple of days, and that will give the core a chance to cool off.
Needs to keep the cooling system going. What makes that cooling system work?
Well, in a word, electricity. The cooling system is really just water, and it gets circulated around by electric pumps, and the earthquake knocked out the main source of power for those pumps. Fortunately, there is a backup system of diesel generators, and that was supposed to kick in. Unfortunately, it didn't work. Mm. So, you know, that could have been because the tsunami damaged generators. In any case, what's left is the final source of backup power, and that's a bunch of batteries.
Batteries that give how much power in all?
Kind of depends who you ask. I've heard everywhere between 4 and 8 hours. Even assuming it is 8 hours, if you do the math here, you realize that the initial set of batteries is probably just about gone.
Well, with that clock ticking then, John, what is the government in Japan trying to do?
Several things. Obviously, they're trying to restore the main power. That is actually just the electrical grid, which would get the generators working again. There are also reports that the U.S. and Japan have been working together to bring in another source of power, and that could be new batteries, it could be new generators, it could be a way to repair the existing diesel generators. Flying in generators, though, I should say, is a hard thing to do because they are really heavy, and so your average helicopter is going to have trouble lifting them in.
And John, if all of this fails, what then?
If it all fails, first, the core of the reactor will start to heat up. There are some indications that may already be happening. And when the core heats up, that turns the cooling water into steam, and that builds up pressure in the system. You can ease that pressure if you vent some of the steam. The problem is, and I understand that they may actually be thinking about doing this already. There's been some talk of that. The problem is that at this point, the steam is actually slightly radioactive, so it's not a great option. And also, when you release steam, you are actually losing water from the system, and you need that water to keep the core from overheating. So if the core gets hot enough, if you run out of water, the core gets hot enough, it will actually melt. That's what happened, as some of us will recall, at Three Mile Island. Mm-hmm. And when the core melts, it can release gases and particles that are highly radioactive, and those particles can get also caught up in steam that's released. I should say nuclear plants are designed so that even when the core melts, all the radioactivity inside is supposed to stay inside what they call the containment structure.
Well, John, as you're talking to people about what's going on with this plant, are they envisioning a scenario like Three Mile Island?
So far, you're not hearing a lot of that kind of talk. Now, the Japanese officials are saying that they see very little chance of this being a Three Mile Island type event, certainly not Chernobyl. On the other hand, it should be said that this is one of Japan's oldest nuclear plants. It was built way back in the 60s, started operating, I think, in 1971. And because it's so old, that means it is probably more vulnerable to some kind of catastrophic failure.
And as we mentioned, they have evacuated thousands of people from this area.
They have.
NPR's John Hamilton, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Space Shuttle Discovery made its final homecoming this week, landing safely in Florida. Its next voyage will not be to space, but to a museum. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports that as NASA retires its shuttle fleet, even some small museums think they have a good chance of landing a spaceship that will rocket them into the big time.
A couple of years ago, Zach Cummings was driving to his job at a Texas oil field engineering firm. He was listening to a morning talk show, and the radio guys said NASA was accepting requests from places that wanted to get a used space shuttle.
So they were just kind of giggling about it and joking on the radio.
Cummings happened to be passing the campus of Texas A&M University, where he'd gone to school.
I thought, wow, what a great idea. Wouldn't it be nice if we could get it in Texas?
Now, you might think any retired shuttle headed for Texas would go to Houston, home of Mission Control. And indeed, the Space Center in Houston has requested one. But Cummings thought, why not my town? And so it came to pass that he got a new job, drumming up support for bringing a shuttle to the Brazos Valley in Texas. Deborah Kalman runs the local Natural History Museum. It exhibits things like minerals and fossils.
When you first walk in, I think one of the things you would be struck with is a complete skeleton of an Ice Age cave bear.
But her vision is that a space shuttle will be the centerpiece of an expanded museum built on the campus of Texas A&M, near the library of a former president who likes the idea and says so on the museum's website.
Howdy. I'm President George Bush, and I invite you to participate in an exciting opportunity to obtain a retired space shuttle and display it in an expansion of the Brazos Valley Museum of Natural History.
We have managed to become a very serious contender.
You think you have a real shot at it?
Oh, definitely. I definitely think that we are going to get one of the shuttles.
The trouble is, other museums also think they'd be the perfect showcase. 21 museums, to be precise. NASA only has 3 shuttles, and one of them, Discovery, is basically promised to the Smithsonian. You do the math.
It's going to be a tough decision.
Bob Schrouse is managing the selection process for NASA. He says NASA Administrator Charles Bolden is considering all the options.
At this point, I think anything is possible.
The lucky museums will have to pay about $29 million to prepare and transport the shuttle, and they have to display it indoors. Museums are going all out to impress NASA. Some efforts go way beyond letter-writing campaigns. Seattle's Museum of Flight is already building a huge new exhibit hall with glass walls. All that's missing is the spaceship. Doug King runs the museum.
Almost everybody that you can find says to me, when are we going to get the shuttle? When are we going to hear about the shuttle? It's become a community event.
And if his community is passionate, imagine how folks feel in Florida, where the space shuttles have been their pride and joy for 3 decades.
Every launch of the space shuttle program left here from Kennedy, and more than half of those came back and landed here.
Bill Moore is head of the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. It's planning a $100 million exhibit that will suspend a shuttle in the air to make it look like it's in orbit. Moore says it's only natural that a shuttle would retire in Florida. If one doesn't, the local reaction will be not good.
I think people would be beyond disappointed. This would be a very emotional decision were it not to be placed here.
For Florida's Space Coast and all the other places hoping to bring a bit of history home, the day of reckoning is April 12th. That's when NASA says it will reveal the spaceship's final destinations. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
This next story is about something odd that turned up in the sky over Russia. It wasn't supposed to be there, and no one knew exactly how it got there. Everybody asked, what is this doing here? Including our correspondent Robert Krowich. So he decided to find out.
I have a friend, Ian. Ian Fraser. He went to Siberia in the winter when it's extremely cold. He was writing a book, and he found himself in the little town of Severobaikalsk, where he was taken to, of all places, a greenhouse.
And you go in, and it's humid and filled with tropical plants. And there's a fountain in there.
I can hear the fountain. Who are you talking to?
What you're hearing is the gardener.
Gardener.
A woman named Marina Tabakova. And that's me trying to disguise the fact that I'm not exactly sure always what she's talking about.
Well, what is she talking about?
She very much wanted to tell me the story of the flamingos.
Of the what?
The flamingos.
It's a flamingo.
It's a flamingo.
This was like the biggest thing that had happened there in a while.
Marina's flamingo story has been translated. We fact-checked it. It is not only entirely true, it is so strange. In 2003, in a nearby village, Vernomakova, in the Uskutsky region of Siberia, two boys, Kolya and Maxi Muravyev, were ice fishing, and it's November the 10th, so the temperature is 13 degrees below zero. Very cold.
Kind of a creaky cold.
And sitting there by the Lena River, the two boys look up, and they see what looks like a flamingo, a tropical-looking bird in the sky overhead.
It's snowing, ice all around, and this bird is falling.
What do you mean falling?
It just came out of the sky. It was in a blizzard, as she described it to me, or it was in a snowstorm, and this frozen flamingo plummets on the ground.
In fact, it was a real flamingo.
Yeah.
In Siberia. Now, this has to be unusual.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
this is Cornell ornithologist and flamingo scholar Marita Davison.
Yeah. I was shocked when I heard that.
Because flamingos get cold, but in Siberia, it's really, really cold.
They're on another level, I think, when we're talking about cold.
Yeah, but what was it doing there? Why was...
I'm stumped, Robert. I just... I don't know.
The Muravyev boys then took that flamingo home to their family apartment. They fed it ground fish, buckwheat, which is not normal flamingo food. They warmed it up, and gradually it got better. It even bit the family dog. We have a picture of it in the living room by the TV set, eating from a bucket.
Yeah, this is the flamingo. This
you can see it on our website, by the way. It's not. It's huge for a house pet.
Yeah.
So after a few weeks, the Muravyevs agreed to have the flamingo transferred to someplace warmer. And the nearest warm place was Marina Tabakova's greenhouse. Mm-hmm. She took care of it until it finally got moved to a Siberian zoo, and that should be the end of the story, except...
It happened twice, right?
Yeah, 1 year later.
I think it was even the same month, in November.
Yeah, November 2004, another bird comes flying out of the sky by another Siberian river, the Yenisei River, and again...
It's a flamingo.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The second flamingo was also rescued. It was also taken to Marina's greenhouse, which then also taken to that same zoo. So you have to wonder, what are the odds of two solitary flamingos falling out of the sky in two successive years in Siberia?
It's pretty remote.
Exactly.
And then it makes me wonder, uh-huh. You know, then how many of these birds... were there and just weren't found.
After all, says Marita Davison, flamingos are social animals.
Right. They like being in groups.
So if you find one all by itself?
It's not normal.
Which means what? You think there were flocks of flamingos flying over Siberia?
Yeah, yes.
Oh, come on. What's your evidence for such a thing?
That's a good question, and I don't know that we really know the full range as far as their tolerance for temperature, but, you know, when we... kind of combed through and dug a little deeper, it seems like it's happened before.
About 100 years ago, also in November, also in Siberia, there were also multiple sightings by hunters and by scientists of batches of flamingos.
Quite a few sightings of birds in flocks as large as 30 birds, I believe.
And what were they doing there?
Gee, I really don't know. But... as we were digging around, there's a phenomenon that's actually more common than you would think in migrating birds, the phenomenon of reverse migration, where they will travel on a route that is exactly 180 degrees in the opposite direction.
Because something inside in their wiring gets flipped. Now, this is well established in some birds, up to now not in flamingos, but you could imagine a bunch of flamingos in Kazakhstan, where they do sometimes live, and they're done raising their babies. It's November.
Which is around the time that they would be trying to get out of there.
So they take off for their fall trip back to the south, and for whatever reason, maybe reverse wiring, they, says Marita,
most likely just got turned around trying to get to their wintering grounds.
Which is where?
Which is towards the southern shores of the Caspian Sea.
In Iran. And is that by some chance exactly the opposite direction from Uskutsk, which is our town in Siberia?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, we could do, if we just kind of roughly eyeball it, I think you look at it and it seems like it's exactly 180 degrees off.
Wow.
And about the same distance, you know, give or take, depending on where we're talking, but about the same distance. So that kind of suggests to me that perhaps this reverse migration is what we're seeing happening.
Uh-huh.
Maybe these birds just out of sheer survival mode just, you know, went wherever they could and they wound up in Siberia.
Which is why, for the past few years, there have been two lucky flamingos, one called Fila, the other Fima, living in the Krasnoyarsk Zoo. And if a little kid comes by and says, well, what are they doing here, Mom? Maybe now we know. Robert Krulwich, NPR News.
We checked with the zoo to see if the birds are still there, and it turns out both of them did stay in Siberia, although one of them, sadly, recently passed away.
And finally this week, we've got the story of a novel substance that just might have been able to stop the flow of oil from the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. You might have played with it in kindergarten. NPR science correspondent Richard Harris talked about it with Scott Simon on Weekend Edition.
Well, you may have been thumbing through your February 4th issue of Physical Review Letters, and I know I think they have the best coverage of the Kardashian sisters. You might have noticed an article entitled Viscoelastic Suppression of Gravity-Driven Counterflow Instability. Well... maybe you went right past it, but it may have been worth a look because despite that title, the article describes how engineers might have been able to stop the BP blowout last year using a child's plaything. Speaking of child's playthings, let's turn to NPR science correspondent Richard Harris with the story. Richard, I think the best question to begin with is, huh?
Well, Scott, if you look in front of you, there's something that may or may not be familiar to you. This is the child's plaything. It's called oobleck.
Right, which is a cornstarch and water
mix, and in this case with a little green food coloring just for amusement's sake. Try stirring it very slowly, and you notice you can actually stir it if you're going nice and slowly.
Yes, right.
Try to stir it fast, what happens?
Can't.
It turns stiff. It absolutely becomes a solid material. It's the strangest thing, just cornstarch and water, and it has these bizarre properties. Well, let's turn the clock back to last May when the BP oil well in the Gulf was flowing out of control. U.S. Energy Secretary Stephen Chu decided to put together a small group of creative physicists to offer him advice about the catastrophe. One of them was a guy named Jonathan Katz, a physics professor at Washington University in St. Louis. Well, Katz was on hand when BP tried to stop the well by pumping dense fluid called drilling mud down it, the so-called top kill approach. It failed.
Well, we'd predicted that, so we're, I guess, disappointed like everybody else was, but not enormously surprised. And so I was scratching my head and saying, is there some solution to this problem?
The problem, as Katz saw it, was that oil and gas blasting up the well tended to break up the drilling mud into fine particles, and a light mist like that ends up getting shot up the pipe and dumped onto the seafloor. Katz wondered whether there was some kind of fluid that wouldn't immediately be dispersed into itty-bitty particles when it encountered the rapidly flowing oil.
And I realized after a while that, hey, wait a second, cornstarch suspensions, oobleck as the kids call it, has this wonderful property that if it's not flowing rapidly, it's a liquid that flows pretty well. But if you try to make it flow rapidly, it suddenly turns stiff and elastic and doesn't flow at all.
Oobleck versus a stream of bubbling hot oil? Really? Yeah, really.
Made some rough estimates. It looked like it was going to work.
And Katz had an inside track here. Being on the Energy Secretary's advisory panel, he participated in daily phone briefings and frequent email exchanges. He had about as much access as you could hope.
So I certainly sent it to everybody on the lists, and I don't know who read it. You can never tell.
Katz was actually dismissed from the panel shortly thereafter. People discovered some controversial social opinions on his website. Even so, Katz says he still dreamed that his idea could solve the problem and end in triumph. Of course, it didn't work out that way.
I don't fault the pros. They have a toolbox, they use the tools in their toolbox. This isn't the place to do physics experiments, especially not ones that would cost quite a bit of money.
Cornstarch is cheap, but the rest of the operation would not be.
And of course, the drilling mud industry isn't used to mixing cornstarch into their stuff, so it would have been completely new for them. It wasn't something they had available in their tanks, you know, ready to go. They would have had to prepare a custom solution, put it on the barges, or take it out to the well.
Not happening. Instead, after BP stopped the well through more conventional means, Katz and some associates at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory did a small-scale experiment with cornstarch and mineral oil. And, as they report in that Physical Review Letters article, it all performed as Katz had predicted, under these highly idealized circumstances. Whether it would have worked in the real world is an open question. Steve Worley, who teaches fluid dynamics at Purdue University, says the concept is clever.
The problem with using something like cornstarch and water is getting it to where it needs to be.
You'd have to pump a lot of it fast into the well if it's going to work. And picture what it would look like inside a pump. Remember, oobleck gets stiff when it's under pressure.
It would tend to create that same reaction when you're trying to pump it down the hole.
And that would make pumping it just about impossible. A BP spokeswoman told NPR their engineers reviewed the idea and decided it wouldn't work. Katz still figures it's a good idea, worth exploring for the next time.
Richard, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
You can learn how to make your own batch of oobleck at npr.org.
And that's it for this week's On Science podcast from the Science Desk at NPR. You can find these stories online at npr.org/sciencepodcast, and we'll see you back here next week. I'm Andrew Prince.